The Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service now presents a special presentation of the New York Association of Independent Living's panel on the 35th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act.
Hello, good afternoon, and welcome to our July webinar, which is celebrating the 35th birthday of the Americans with Disabilities Act, ADA. I'm Blaze Bryant, the communications specialist here at the New York Association on Independent Living, or NYIL. N-Y-A-I-L. A couple of quick housekeeping things before we get into the panel. The first is the webinar is being recorded, and I'll have that made available to you later this week. And then the chat is disabled for all attendees. This is an accessibility accommodation for people who use screen readers. Last thing is, at the end of the webinar, there will be a survey that pops up in your browser. Any feedback? And I really would appreciate if you took the time to fill that out. That helps me plan future webinars, and I look forward to your feedback. Now, on to why we're here, to celebrate the 35th birthday of the ADA. And we have an awesome panel here, starting with Doug Hovey, who is the CEO of Independent Living, Inc. in Newburgh, New York. We have Anita Cameron, who is the new founder and executive director of a very exciting project that, unfortunately, I just blanked on the name, Anita. I am so sorry. Sorry?
We were there, too. Blacks in the disability movement.
Thank you so much. I had it in my notes, and it must have just disappeared, so apologies, and thank you so much. And Stephanie Orlando, who is the new Chief Executive Officer of Western New York Independent Living, or WINL, in Buffalo, New York. Unfortunately, Theo Brady from the National Council on Independent Living is not feeling well enough to join us today. Moderating today's panel is our fantastic Director of Advocacy, Alex Thompson, who will take it from here.
Great. Thank you, Blaze. So I appreciate everyone being here today. As you know, it's, as Blaze said, it's the 35th anniversary of the ADA, and some of us were young children, or maybe not born yet, when the ADA passed, and some of us were there in person advocating for it, and you know, others basically know the history and the trials, the difficulties people with disabilities experienced before the ADA became law. So one of the first questions that we'll go through, and each of you can speak to, is what does the ADA mean to you? And I think what I'd like to do is, maybe if you're comfortable, Anita, starting first, because I'm really interested in hearing, maybe this is connected to this project. We were there too, and if maybe you could speak to what the ADA means to you, and also maybe, you know, if there's connection to this project you're working on.
Thank you. My name is Anita Cameron, A N I T A C A M E R O N. My pronouns are she, they. I am a Black person with caramel colored skin, very long graying locks, and a yellow and Black t-shirt that says nothing about us without us. Oh, the ADA. I just turned 60. A month and 2 days ago. And so obviously, I was born before the Americans with Disabilities Act. When I was a child, kids with disabilities did not have the right to an education. And also I come from Chicago, Illinois, and so the ugly laws were definitely in effect the year that I was born. They would be rescinded when I turned 9 years old in 1974, though they really didn't go away. I had no, because I was considered gifted, I was mainstreamed from preschool through university only because I was gifted. When I was in the fifth grade at age 10, the what was known as the Education of All Handicapped Children went into effect. That would eventually go on to become the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. And so I was able to get accommodations and whatnot. My teachers were very excited. They gave me large print and, all kinds of accommodations, except for one thing. I was told when I entered high school that my accommodations were going to go away. That because I was considered gifted, I didn't need those accommodations anymore. And so I managed to make it through high school and graduated actually early. Went to University of Illinois, where there were absolutely no accommodations whatsoever. And as a matter of fact, was thrown out of medical school because my I was losing more eyesight, seizures got out of control, and I was told to find another career path, which I did. I wound up working at Chicago Lighthouse for the Blind as a rehabilitation service aide. And I did some, some cane technique and some occupational therapy, but my main job was working with a gentleman named Dennis Schreiber, who was deafblind and used a wheelchair. And Dennis was a member of a group called Disabled Americans Rally for Equality, which was the sister and larger chapter of an organization called ADAPT. At that time, ADAPT stood for American Disabled or Accessible Public Transportation. And so I joined ADAPT. I began traveling around the country fighting for access. A year later, I moved to Colorado to work with Wade Blank, founder of ADAPT, and some of the original folks. And in 1990, I was honored to participate in the Capitol Crawl for the Americans with Disabilities Act. And was honored to participate in the Rotunda takeover the following day that resulted in 104 arrests. I was number 81. Of course, folks know a couple of short months later, the Americans with Disabilities Act was signed into law by President George Herbert Walker Bush. So the ADA for me, it meant that I could now go to, because it was interesting because right after the ADA was signed into law, I got a new job in the real world. And so I was able to get a job. My bosses, without me even asking, made accommodations, came to me, asked me what did I need. It was amazing. I was able to go back to school to get my degree in computer information systems. And I had every accommodation I needed, and I wasn't like a unicorn in the class. In other words, I wasn't the only disabled student in my classes. And our campus was fully accessible, including the shuttle buses were wheelchair accessible. I was able to take the bus and get around not only my city, but to get around the country, via Greyhound and all. The ADA allowed me to do so many things that I wasn't able, to do before. And so, for me, the ADA represented opportunity. But I will say, and I'm probably going ahead, but I've always said that the ADA was it was the floor, it wasn't the ceiling, it was the beginning, not the end, but it was still a wonderful, wonderful thing, to have. So I'll end there.
Thank you, Anita, and I appreciate the history. I mean, the Capitol crawl is well known in our community, and those who don't know, I encourage you to look it up, and also the Rotunda takeover. So those of you who are not
And
familiar, just Google those.
I'll go, Alex, on to say, my project does have my project started out as a Twitter rant in 2015. That was the year that we were doing the whole year celebration of the ADA and all. And as I was looking at the materials, at the pictures, at the videos and whatnot, I saw scant, and I mean scant, representation of Black disabled people. It's as if we Black disabled set this out and let white people do all of the work. And we know that that's not true because you just heard my story. And there were many, 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 many of us who's contributed to the disability movement. And unfortunately, our stories are either whitewashed or outright erased. And so the my project actually began because I noticed that. And what I did was in my blog, I named Black activists who are out there in the streets, some of who died. And then I got some funding from Borealis Philanthropy to begin my project, which I will be telling the stories, interviewing Black elders in the movement, chronicling their stories, so that the stories can get out there in this age of the abolition of Black history, teaching in schools. It's so important that people know that we were there too, that we did contribute, that we fought. That we put our bodies, our lives, and in some cases gave our lives. So thank you for allowing me to tie my project in with that. Thanks.
Yeah, it sounds like a great project. Do people want to know more or follow the developments? Can they find you on social media?
Sure. And my website is www.weweretheretoo.com. All one word, lowercase, dot org. www.weweretheretoo.org.
That's excellent. Thank you so much, Anita. I appreciate you sharing all that. I'm going to go to, I think maybe I'll go to you, Doug, next, about what the ADA means to you. stories, influence it's had on your life, whatever you'd like to share.
Yeah, it's been a couple of years, right? Yeah, I'm Doug Hovey. I'm the CEO for Independent Living Incorporated, based here in the Mid-Hudson region, and actually the founding CEO. So I started in 1987, late actually 86, meeting with a group of volunteers to conceive the idea of creating an independent living center, and then applied for that initial grant that got awarded to us in early 87. We started with a $145,000 grant from the State Education Department. And, that's all history, I guess, but it was a really interesting time. And Anita, I appreciated your remarks, and really respect all the work that you do and Not Dead Yet. I wanted to comment on something. I wanted to be able to just to say that those of us who grew up in the disability rights movement know very clearly that it was the Black and Brown community who set the stage for civil rights and fought the hard fight back in the 50s and 60s, and even before that, leading up to the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which in large measure created a framework for the Americans with Disabilities Act. So we always owe a huge debt of gratitude to the Black and Brown community for that. I became disabled 10 years before passage of the ADA in 1980 as a result of an accident, motorcycle accident. I have a spinal cord injury. I am a wheelchair user. And so I know what it was like to live in a pre-ADA world. And it was not pretty at all. It really sucked in so many ways. I mean, it's hard to put into words the feeling, the experience that we had to live through as people with disabilities pre-ADA. I mean, to say there's no curb cuts and parking was limited and there were no accessible ramps, doorways were too narrow, bathrooms were not accessible. And what was really bad was when you'd be in a restaurant, if you could get into the restaurant. And sometimes it meant the kitchen crew coming out and offering to pull you up the steps, but we would always refuse to do steps. And but if you were able to get into a restaurant, you're having a nice meal and you go to use the bathroom, and only to find out that the doorways were only 22 inches wide and you couldn't fit into the bathroom. What did you do? Well, I could tell you what we did, and it wasn't pretty. But so there were a lot of challenges, and even though we had Section 504, the Rehabilitation Act of 1974, that didn't do much for us because it only applied to federally funded programs. And even federally funded programs didn't comply with the law. There was no enforcement or compliance of Section 504. And I remember that. I mean, I went to a SUNY college in 1981 after I had graduated from high school. And I remember how terrible it was. Classrooms were not accessible. Many of them were not accessible. The campus was not accessible. And this is a State University of New York. They had an unwritten policy that if you signed up for a class and you got to the class and it was not accessible, you went and you talked to the Disability Services Office and they would make a request to have the classroom moved. And I can remember doing that on a few different occasions. And it was really uncomfortable because you're literally showing up to a room, sitting outside the staircase that led to the inaccessible classroom, and having to get the attention of the professor, and then, jointly sort of making a complaint and having the classroom moved. So they would not have the class that day, or I wouldn't attend the class, and then they would change the class within a week. They would find another classroom. But it was really awkward. And so what we started doing was signing up for classes that we knew were in inaccessible classrooms to make them change it. We were really pissed off. There was a bunch of us, and we created an on-campus cross-disability support group. We started meeting once a month. We enjoyed meeting and telling stories together so much, we started meeting weekly, and then we started making lots of recommendations to the college. But again, this is all pre-ADA. And then for me, timing was everything. In 1987, I was given the opportunity to develop this independent living center here in the Mid-Hudson region. At that time, there were 12 existing centers in New York State. And then that year, 86, 87, there were 16 new centers. And I was fortunate enough to be the executive director of one of those centers. And that was right at a pivotal time when the ADA was being developed. Right. So there was a lot of talk about this thing called the Americans with Disabilities Act. It sort of looked a lot like the Civil Rights Act, and it was civil rights protections for people with disabilities. And I happen to be even more fortunate because my local congressman, Hamilton Fish, was a major sponsor for the ADA. And he had an office here in my hometown in Newburgh. And he, of course, his DC office. And so here I am, a brand new executive director, about as green as you can imagine. You know, I knew about civil rights. I had marched a few times here and there, but had an awful lot to learn. But I was fortunate enough to be able to visit with my congressman in his office, both here in Newburgh and then in DC on a number of different occasions between 1987 and 1990. And if you recall, the ADA was first presented in 1988 and it did not pass.
Did
Yeah,
not.
it
That's
did
right.
not pass, right?
That's right.
There were still lots of negotiations that had to go on, and there were really ridiculous things that I won't even go into details. But if you ever have a chance to hear Jim Weissman talk about those days, Jim was one of the attorneys who was helping to defend the ADA. But some of the stories he will tell you are just will blow your mind away. The things that some of the congressional leaders were concerned about, you know, people with no arms eating with their feet, you know, I mean. You know, on trains, right? Or all these disabled people are going to be on the trains, and there's not going to be any room for non-disabled people. You know, there was ridiculous reasons that first time to not pass the legislation. So, but just 2 short years later, of course, it was passed. So that's a little bit about my history. I know we're going to have other questions, so I don't want to jump ahead. But you know. There's a lot more to do, no doubt. We have a lot of work to do. And civil rights protections are, they're not one and done. They're never one and done. But you know, fortunately, the ADA doesn't have to be reauthorized like IDEA or the Rehabilitation Act of 1974. I mean, those acts, the Air Carrier Act of 1988, those things all have to be reauthorized. And so, I mean, a part of our challenge is to make sure that we're aware of those reauthorizations and that we're very, you know, militant. And then, you know, in a few minutes, hopefully, you know, we'll talk more, but well, under the question about threats, you know, I certainly want to talk about the lawsuit in Texas, you know, because I think that's pivotal. But I'll pass the baton.
Yeah, thank you, Doug. I appreciate it. And I guess following, what Anita and Doug said, that we were not just given the ADA, we did have to fight for it. So, advocacy is really important to what NILE does and the ILCs do and what Anita does. So I'm gonna switch to you, Stephanie. If you can share any, your thoughts, experiences with the ADA, what does the ADA mean to you on this, as we celebrate the 35th anniversary?
Hi everyone, I'm Stephanie Orlando and I use she, her pronouns. I'm a Caucasian woman with light brown hair with some grays in it. I tend to look younger than I am. I wear glasses and I have on a blue blouse with white stripes today. I'm the third CEO of Western New York Independent Living. I'm following in the footsteps of Douglas Usiak, who was our longest running executive director, CEO, and really came in right at the beginning of our organization. And I started in this movement as a teenager. I've really had the privilege of being exposed to peer support by the time I was 14 years old, and was in peer support groups where I was with other young people with disabilities. My gateway into this movement was actually through mental health, and I want to highlight that because that, in my time, has always been something that not all people have always recognized, is how mental health fits in with disability rights and the disability community in terms of fighting for our rights. And over time, that's really grown and changed. And I know that's something that Doug Hovey and his center have really focused on as well. But I really have had the opportunity to engage with my elders who have fought for the rights that I have absolutely had the benefit of, having an existence. And I don't take them for granted. And I don't think that there's enough education around disability rights and where those rights have come from, who fought for them. And it's something that I have previously fought to have part of the standard New York State curriculum, and really do think that it's important to understand our history because it's so easy to backslide. And I know we're going to talk about this more later today, but in the sense of what it means to me, like I think that it's very important to know where these rights came from because I had no idea until recent times how easy it would be to go back to the days of ugly laws, like Anita Cameron said earlier. I would teach disability history and talk about ugly laws, and I'd be like, could you believe it was in the 70s? It was so recent. But I never thought to myself, wow, that'll be a threat again in your leadership time that you're going to have to defend. I've had the privilege of attending with the National Youth Movement anniversaries for the ADA with President Bush, and being able to hear from the people that fought for it, the people that passed it, and understand really that it wasn't easy and that these things shouldn't be taken for granted and that there's more work to do. And even as we want to, I know one of the questions later is open, like what would we change about the ADA? We have to be concerned even to make it stronger, that we open up this opportunity and someone's going to be there to weaken it. So to me, the ADA is freedom. I was placed in a residential facility as a youth. I was told I couldn't get help for my disability outside of a residential facility. I dropped out of school on my 16th birthday and got my high school equivalency diploma at 17 and went on to college. I don't have to fear if I need to request accommodations at school or work. There is certainly still discrimination, but I have rights. I think that our human rights are important in the disability world, our life to live. But when I think of our civil rights and our constitutional rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, I think that the ADA really opens the door to that. Like not just living, but thriving, living joyful lives, living lives that fill us with a sense of pride and meaning. I think that the ADA eliminated a lot of those barriers and caused a lot of opportunities to enforce those laws, whereas before it wasn't there. And so we really need to continue to fight for those freedoms and make sure that they aren't rolled back, because there are so many things that we will lose access to in terms of opportunity, in terms of physical access to buildings, or to locations, but those attitudinal barriers too. If it wasn't for the ADA, we wouldn't be out there educating people about people with disabilities in a way that the general public knows that it's their responsibility to know something about how to accommodate people with disabilities and how to speak to people with disabilities without marginalizing or minimizing their worth. I'll leave it there because I think we do have a lot of questions that we'll get to some of the other things that I want to speak to.
Yeah, I think I'm going to have to combine some of these questions a little bit, but I really appreciate that, Stephanie. It was great. I was listening to an interview recently that the National NDRN podcast, they were interviewing Jim Dixon, who is a well-known historian of the disability rights movement, and he specifically talked about discussions about excluding certain disability populations like mental health or people with developmental disabilities to just get it passed. And thankfully that was not done. And it is an inclusive civil rights act that the ADA was passed that way. So thank you for mentioning that population.
And if I may also include, like, we recognize substance use disorders, and there's a lot of work around that as well in terms of people who are living with substance use disorders, have addiction histories that, we also have protections for people with those ex firsthand experiences.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. So the next question, I think the way we had it written was talking about, threats to the ADA. How can advocates protect the ADA on the federal level? But I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask that question, maybe also combine it with, we're talking of, we've talked a little bit about enforcement, the importance of enforcement. And, steps advocates can take to protect and strengthen the ADA in their community. So I guess, if you have thoughts about, advocacy on the federal level protecting the ADA, but then also, how can advocates locally, here in New York, here in their local communities get involved with protecting and strengthening the ADA? I think that's how we're gonna maybe save some time and try to get through all these questions. So, maybe what I'll do is I'll go in reverse order. So maybe I'll start with you, Stephanie.
Okay. Now I'm like thrown off because you're combining a question, two questions, and I got one, but not the other one.
Yeah, so I think we're gonna talk about threats to the at the federal level and protecting the ADA on the federal level, because that I think you kind of spoke to already, and you made some really good points about, when we open up the ADA, there could be threats as much as there are, opportunities to strengthen the
I don't know
law.
if you, I hate to back out, but I'm kind of thinking that maybe, Doug, if you want to start with that lawsuit that you were mentioning earlier, that might be a good segue for
Sure.
that first.
Yeah.
That makes sense. Yeah. Let's go there.
Yeah, great, great. And keep in mind that, any time that civil rights are being attacked or threatened or rolled back or whatever you want to call it, they're always threats that are developing in different parts of the country. And most recently, with Section 504, there was a lawsuit. It was Texas versus Becerra, I believe it was. Becerra was the Secretary of Health and Human Services at the time, right? And that's the department that oversees implementation of the federal legislation, right? So Section 504 was being attacked and being threatened by 17 states who had joined together they were alleging that Section 504 was unconstitutional, and that was huge. That's a major threat to disability policy, to disability law, and anytime there's a threat like that, that jeopardizes and threatens the integrity of the Americans with Disabilities Act. Anytime there's threats to the Civil Rights Act of 64, that threatens all of us, and it includes people with disabilities, right? I mean, we have to remember that there's sort of a foundation of civil rights in this country, and we're all part of a broader civil rights movement. And any part of civil rights that's being attacked is going to ultimately impact all of us, including people with disabilities. And what can we do about that, right? I mean, obviously, we want to continue to file our complaints. We want to be vocal. We want to work with the Office of Civil Rights here in New York State, which, by the way, is where the ADA is enforced through New York State legislation. So, one of the many great things that the Independent Living Centers have done over many years is to get legislation passed that ratifies the ADA in state law. So, that's huge, right? So, we have the federal law, but then we have the state law that is governed by the Office of Civil Rights. So we have worked with John Herrien for many years when he worked with the Office of Civil Rights as the lead disability attorney. And John was always very responsive. And if we had local complaints, he was never hesitant to send a letter off, on the OCR letterhead, letting a municipality know they were in violation. So we had situations like that occur. So working with your Office of Civil Rights, working with the EEOC and filing complaints, when it comes to employment discrimination. That's key. I mean, we have protections under Title I, right, for employment. We have protections for state and local government, which is huge. I don't know if we're going to get into Olmstead today, but if I were to have to pick one area that probably I see as most pivotal over the last 35 years, it would have been, the Title II lawsuit against Georgia, the state of Georgia, leading to the Olmstead decision, giving people with disabilities the right to live, work, and play in the community like other non-disabled people. I mean, that was huge. So,
I'm a bar for you.
anytime there's an attack again on any part of civil rights, we really have to mobilize and come together and support each other. That's so critical. So, that was the Section 504 lawsuit in Texas. They have since backed off on that. They're not continuing the lawsuit. So, but again, we have to be watchful, mindful, and militant and stay on top of these developing situations.
That's great. Thank you, Doug. And I think I'm just going to do a quick follow-up question. Just kind of, Doug, you and Stephanie are, directors of independent living centers, and you mentioned filing complaints or doing that kind of advocacy. If someone is new to that and has no experience in that, can an independent living center, do you have folks that can help people go through those processes or best identify, how to pursue that kind of advocacy?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I would think that all 41 centers would be a great locus, point of contact in local communities to, file suits, to make complaints. And we have complaints that come to us, and sometimes the first level of advocacy comes from the independent living center itself, putting a strong letter on letterhead from the center to whatever it is, the municipality or the local business, the employer, whatever it happens to be. And we had a situation that was recently where there was a new affordable housing complex that was being developed. And the developer called me and asked me if I would write a letter of support. And I said, sure, can you send me the plans? Well, after reviewing the plans, we found 15 ADA violations. So I wrote a letter back to the developer letting him know. And so cited each of those violations. He had his architect call me and tell me that he was the greatest architect in the galaxy and that he knew better than me. And so at that point, I sent a letter to him, carbon copied HCR, Homes and Community Renewal, because they were financing the thing. HCR, to their credit, here we are, a New York State agency, contacted me and put me in touch with their architect, who agreed with my assessment, my interpretation of the ADA as it applied to that building, and they stopped the project until they fixed their deficits. So, really depending on our government, when you can, right? Work from the government, we're here to help. I know there are times when we can't depend on government, but there are times we can, and we really should for enforcement, because the biggest challenge, I think, in the ADA going forward is always going to be enforcement of the law at the local level.
This is Stephanie, and I very much want to build off of that and your earlier answer. So I see on the call today is Frank Camerata, who is our
I
Erie
think we just
County
lost.
ADA coordinator.
Sorry, Stephanie. We lost the interpreter for a second. So I think
Okay.
we have an interpreter back now. Okay. So let's, if you could just, sorry, I say, hate to say it, but if you could restart just for
Sure.
accessibility.
Okay. So again, this is Stephanie, and I'm building off of what Doug Hovey just said. And I think with independent living centers, we work collaboratively with our local ADA coordinators. And today on the call, I see that Frank Camerata is on, and he's our Erie County ADA coordinator. And Western New York Independent Living, throughout our existence, has actually pushed localities to have ADA coordinators and ensure that there are ADA coordinators. So in addition to filing complaints and doing the process of helping move things along, we also work to ensure that the proper people are in place and able to be knowledgeable about the ADA, their responsibilities in their localities for meeting those needs. And when we have an issue with a public space, we call them and we work collaboratively with them to address that need. So on all levels, an independent living center is here to help fight for the rights of people with disabilities and make sure those rights are realized and that, our protections are real, that they're not just on paper filed away somewhere, but that we feel them every day. And, as we were saying earlier, they're under threat. I wanted Doug to talk about that 504 lawsuit because, too, we're seeing with like the Department of Energy looking to make their buildings not have to follow the guidelines for accessibility. It's the beginning of tearing down again 504 and this concept of that all public spaces have to be made accessible. If federal money goes towards them, they need to be accessible to all of our citizens. And that, we have things to offer. We are not just this one view of disability. Disability is diverse. We're the largest and most diverse minority group. And I think, as Anita was saying earlier, we need to recognize all of the contributions that people have. And I think there's still this negative view of disability that isn't accurate that's out there. And we need to continue to push and make sure that we have the right people in place that understand the complexities and differences and trying to meet that universal design of being accessible for everyone, and really working collaboratively with us. That does not come naturally. It is something that has to be worked at and defended and done with intention. And I think that an independent living center is definitely one for that. And I agree with Doug that I want to talk about Olmsted more, because when we really think about a landmark decision that came out of the Americans with Disabilities Act, the Olmsted decision really said that we need to be in the most integrated settings. And as I mentioned earlier, I've been in residential placement. I've been restricted. There's so many more opportunities for people to be served in the community, and to defend that right is really important. And I think we'll talk more about that. So I'll end there.
Great, thank you, Stephanie. So now I'm gonna to go to you, Anita, and I'm just gonna repeat the question. So, how can advocates protect the ADA on the federal level, and also, if there's any threats you're aware of for the ADA or federal threats, and then also, what steps can advocates take to protect and strengthen the ADA in their communities?
I mean, on the federal level, you certainly can work with your members of Congress and work with federal agencies to, protect the ADA. But those things are under threat, are they not? In the community, certainly. What Stephanie was saying, but also, y'all asked for Anita Cameron. You're gonna get Anita Cameron. I am militant, and y'all know that. I'm militantly nonviolent. At some point, and I believed in a multi-pronged approach to advocacy. That, certainly going the legal route, with lodging complaints and lawsuits, getting the Department of Justice involved. I actually did a DOJ complaint against Greyhound last year. Specifically, because of their ADA violations. In your, on the local level, I'm all for educating people. But I am not averse to and have written many a strong letter to entities and all who are in violation. I believe in direct action because after a while, lawsuits take time, working with legislators and everything takes time, even working with your city officials, and if in fact they have ADA coordinators, and if they have them, if those ADA coordinators know their jobs and what they're doing, because it's been my experience that often they don't. And so, when one has, exhausted or has gone as far as, or even in conjunction with, that, I see nothing wrong with gathering some folks at an entity and shutting it down. Done it before many times. And yes, it does work. I have no qualms about writing a strong letter to an entity and giving them a reasonable period of time, 30 to 90 days to get the thing done. And if you don't, I am there with a number of people shutting down your business and having the media involved as well. And not even limited to mainstream media, but hey, that's what Facebook, TikTok, Instagram, all this is for. You can use social media in in that protection of people's rights. And I believe disability rights leaves large groups of people behind. I believe in disability justice. And there's a way to doing th things that involves being very intentional, being thinking about things in an intersectional fashion and all. But there's only so they're all good tools and all the legal and all of that. They're all very, very good tools. And it's very, very good. There are members of Congress that I know on a first name basis. We work together so much. There are mayors, past mayors of my city that I know on a first name basis because we work together, to address access. And I see nothing wrong that, with going to city council and bringing this to city council and getting as many eyes on this as possible, getting your city council members involved, getting your state assembly folk involved in this. And also, obviously, independent living centers are invaluable. I spent most of my career working at independent living centers around the country. And for disability organizations like American Association of People with Disabilities, Jim Dixon was my supervisor. Love him. And so there's lots of ways that you can do it. I think a lot of times when we talk about these things, I think we a lot of times tend to forget that there are folks with disabilities who may not have a connection to an independent living center, or don't necessarily have a way to, to do things. And that's where, to me, the direct action, the writing, the education, blog about it. I remember blogging about my doctor's inaccessible office. And when I blogged about it and it went viral, he made it accessible. I remember shortly after when the Obama administration came in and they were doing their little meetings and all. And in Rochester, they met at a place that was inaccessible. It should not have been because they had just renovated it using some federal funds. And so I go in to find that the meeting is upstairs and there's no elevator. I made them bring that meeting down and then blogged about the fact that that venue was inaccessible. And within 30 days, the venue had built a beautiful ramp in. So sometimes direct action may not necessarily mean protesting, means writing about it and putting it out there, putting it on Front Street. But we are living in some troubling times. And I've always said, I have a statement that I'm famous for. It's in my email signatures. Civil rights aren't given. You have to fight to get them and then fight to keep them. And we are definitely in the fighting to keep them stage now, aren't we? And the ADA, so 504 being attacked and certain things within 504 being attacked, the Americans with Disabilities Act, there's attacks on Olmstead now. And remembering that as much landmark and everything as it is, it once again is the base. Olmstead even is the base, because Olmstead refers, to people at risk of institutionalization. It doesn't address, you know what the ADA doesn't. I'm just going to go ahead, because the main thing to me that the ADA did not address, and obviously it couldn't because I remember a lot of the shenanigans going on, and the weird questions people were coming up with and all. But the ADA does not address literally the civil right to live in the community in freedom. It addresses the right to be and get around in the community and public accommodations and all. But right now, disabled people don't have the civil right to live in freedom. We know what's going on here in New York with CDPAP and the fiscals and all and the threats and the dangers. And I know a dear friend here in Rochester who did pass away in the midst of this. And so there are lots of ways that we can do. I think what we need to make sure is that ordinary disabled people feel that they can do stuff, that you don't have to have a degree to do this, that you don't have to have an education to do this. The people that I worked with, that I chaired with them, I knew a lot of people who were hid in the back rooms in their homes and never got an education at all. Well, they grew up in institutions, and then they got out. I knew a guy had been in a nursing home for 43 years and finally was able to get out. And a lot of us, we don't have that, that access. We have to let people know that you don't have to be a professional disabled to do this. You can be an ordinary disabled person, senior. You can even be an ordinary disabled youth. Stephanie, I remember you from a long, long time ago in your youth and attending youth conferences, and all of that. That's what we need, because it's going to take the ordinary people too, not just the one who knows the Beltway and who knows Albany, and who knows. We got to get the ordinary people involved in this and let the ordinary people know that they can fight too in their own way, and that there is hope, even though things are under threat. I think I'll end right there.
That's really powerful. Thank you, Anita. And I like how you brought Stephanie in too. That's really important that we get younger people, and not just younger people, but new advocates. So you can start at any age, like Anita said. I mean, somebody living in a nursing home for over 40 years, and then they're out and they're getting engaged in advocacy. So don't feel like you've missed the boat on, getting involved with this stuff. So we're down to kind of the last 5 minutes. So I think I'm just gonna have a quick a quick question maybe for Stephanie and Doug. Just on, are there any words you could share for young or new advocates, or anything that you would maybe very quickly like change about the ADA or add to the ADA? So I'll start with you, Stephanie.
Yeah, this is Stephanie. I would like to say that I do have messages for young people. However, I think I have a stronger message for all of us, and I'm including myself. Like, I feel like the youth movement really lose a lot of support over the years. Like, a lot of the things that were there when I was young aren't in place nationally for us to connect and to work together collaboratively. There's still some things, but not like we were. And so I think that it's really our responsibility, and I really feel a profound responsibility to reach back and help mentor and bring up the next generation. And that's not a job, that's like a commitment that you make. That's long term. I did this as a job, and now I'm in a CEO position, and I still keep in touch with several of the people that I worked with in my previous role, and continue to see them do amazing things and go off in their own directions. And I think that's really important that we act as mentors and supports for emerging leaders, and I do like to think of emerging leaders. And as an ed, you can become a advocate at any age and think of yourself as emerging and like hungry for that experience. One of the things that I used to do, I'm a founder of Youth Power, and Lauren Tenney, who was one of my mentors, she has her PhD, and she wrote her thesis on the stages of Black liberation and how they run parallel to, well, she used the word mental patient liberation. And the idea, it starts off with this, in the stages of Black liberation, it starts with encounter. And that you simply have to encounter someone that opens your mind to the advocacy as possible. And I think we need to be out there shaking hands and kissing babies and showing that being in encounterable. Like, if we just are all behind the Zoom in our computer spaces, not getting out to where people with disabilities are of all ages, then we're not saying like you're not alone. There's someone out there that thinks your voice is important and, can help be that megaphone, can help offer that open door to walk through and share your story, make that connection for you. And I think that's really our responsibility. And tell the young people, it's and emerging leaders, it's your responsibility to take that hand, to walk through that door, and to ask questions and to bring ideas, and know that you're worth a lot in our movement. You are our asset, you are our future. We used to do a chant, youth are the future and the future is now. You have value right here and now, not just in the future. You can offer something to make sure that we're engaging young people with disabilities who have really been pushed to an even more marginalized space with COVID, and not being heard and not being out there in the community, like I said, to have those encounter opportunities. So I really hope that we do more to bring fun activities, fundraisers. We just had Disability Pride in Western New York in Buffalo this past weekend, and wow, did people show up, and wow, did people get the message that they have strength and power, and there's power in unity. And I hope we carry that message forward.
We just have like a minute. The recording's going to be posted and we'll send an email out. But Doug, do you have any? Sorry, we're
Sorry,
short on time.
Doug. No. Are you kidding me? I think we all had a good chance to speak today. But I agree that sustaining the future by cultivating the talent of young people is just so key. We really have to be mindful of that and be looking locally. The other thing we could do locally is to, I mean, in Orange County alone, we have 43 municipalities. So, reach out to every municipal leader in your community and build a relationship. Work with them to do self-evaluations and transition plans. We've done several in the region, in the area, over several years. I wish we could do one for every municipality, but that's a good way to begin developing those relationships and educating and creating more expectation at the local level. So I think that's key, but stronger enforcement is definitely needed. We need new methodologies and new mechanisms for enforcement. It shouldn't be left up to simply disabled people to be using the ADA as their tool. I mean, we need enforcement from state government. The state should be a role model in developing their ADA self-evaluation and transition plans and enforcing the ADA throughout all of the state agencies and state offices. And then, of course, all of our municipal, we're taxpayers, right? We pay a lot of taxes as people with disabilities, and municipalities and government should be fully accessible and in compliance with the law. And that's the expectation.